In a recent article headed How a Sleepy German Suburb Explains Europe's Rising Far-Right Movements, Amanda Taub, a reporter for the New York Times Interpreter, explains why extremist populism has found fertile ground in Europe. She's examined how the residents of a middle-class, mostly white suburb of Berlin view immigration and the refugee crisis and how those views translate into political beliefs. Ms. Taub, a former human rights lawyer, joins us now to discuss the growing appeal of far-right politics. Welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Where is Buch, Germany?
So Buch is technically part of Berlin, but it is on the very edge of the city, and it's essentially a little suburb in and of itself. It's got its own main street, a very old church, and a lot of kind of normal commuter families living there in this little community.
In the former East or West Germany?
It's in the former East. So for many years, in East Germany, Buch was actually a hospital city. They had very large medical centers that people came from all over the region to go to. But after the wall fell, most of that got shut down, and it's really become a commuter city. It has some new centers for research going there, but it's changed quite a bit since the Soviet Union fell.
Its citizens lived for decades under communist rule. Does that experience play a role in the rise of far-right populism?
I think it does in a way. So when I went to Buch to find out what was going on, I found that there were a few different factors that were playing a big role. And one of them that I wrote about was the sense of a lost identity. So right now in Germany, this is something that I've heard from a lot of people, that they're trying to define what it is to be German, what it means to be part of that country today, now that it's part of the European Union. But for people in the East, that's a particularly complicated question because they have seen such changes in their communities, and their identities have changed not just because they're part of modern Germany, but because they used to be part of the East and now are part of this reunified country.
And you quote a woman, Cornelia Rüder, a pastor in Buch, who says that Germans have an inner emptiness. The gap in self-definition has left them no way to express their identity except by what they're not.
Right. So this was something that she had seen. She's a pastor, and this was something that she's seen in a lot of her parishioners and other people from the community that she's met through, you know, she's essentially a leader there. And she said that she sees this as a real problem, that because people don't have a way, she said, to say what they are, they don't know how to finish the sentence, I am, they focus more on what they're not. So they say, I'm not a Muslim, I'm not a foreigner, et cetera. And that has created a real opening for far-right parties like the Alternative for Germany, the new kind of populist far-right party there, which is able to exploit that sense of identity and also is very willing to participate in the kind of othering of outsiders.
Isn't this an issue you explored in depth in a previous New York Times article, Germany's Taboos, Once a Bulwark Against the Far Right, May Now Be Enabling It? Why is finding a sense of identity and belonging so difficult in Germany? Is it because of the Nazi past the discussion of German nationalism is taboo?
I think that's a big part of it. After World War II, as Germany worked to kind of rejoin the community of nations and particularly become a member in good standing of Europe, there was a pretty conscious decision made that they would stay away from anything that seemed like nationalism, even things that in another country might just seem like ordinary patriotism or national identity. They saw as a potential step down the road that had once led to Nazism. But the result is that, especially for young people who see that as something that's far in Germany's past, there's this kind of empty space, and they're looking for a way to fill it.
So they're able to ignore the Nazi past?
I think it's, for some, they would like to ignore it. Certainly, I attended a rally that was organized by the AfD's youth wing and talked to several young people there who said that, you know, in their opinion, this was a short period of Germany's history that happened a long time ago, and they didn't understand why it needed to continue to influence things so much today. But I think for a lot of people, even if they don't think it should be ignored, they feel that it is something that is controlling the conversation and controlling the kind of contours of what identity is allowed to look like, and they're starting to chafe at those rules.
You describe Buch as the kind of place Goldilocks would declare just right. Not too hot, not too cold, picture perfect.
So I think the thing I was trying to convey there is that we think of far-right politics as coming from extreme places. You know, I think we tend to picture, you know, the town where all the factories have closed and people are terribly poor and terribly angry. And Buch wasn't like that at all. You know, it's a quiet suburb. It was the sort of place where I could absolutely understand why somebody with a young family would want to move out there. You know, it's not too close to the center, so it's green and leafy. It's not too far away, so you can still commute. It's not poor, it doesn't feel dangerous, but at the same time, it's not so expensive that people can't afford to have a nice life there.
And you're right that the population of Buch is mostly white. Do right. immigrants and refugees live there as well?
They do. There's a small refugee center that has been kind of plonked down in the center of town, in the middle of a park. And it's very noticeable because in Germany, they have... they've come up with a way to build refugee centers very quickly that involves repurposed shipping containers that are in bright primary colors. So it almost looks like a kind of Lego building in the middle of town. And a few hundred refugees live there, mostly families with young children.
Wasn't the Buch Refugee Center recently attacked by an arsonist? The fire was set in a room containing baby strollers.
Yeah, it was very sad. Actually, one of their buildings has been rendered completely unusable because somebody, they're still not sure who, the crime is unsolved, set a fire in the room that was used for these families' baby carriage storage. And I've seen photos of, you know, I saw the outside of the building, which is now condemned, and I've seen photos of the inside from the immediate aftermath. And, you know, it was so sad. There were just charred wheels and... you know, the kind of destroyed remains of these baby carriages.
And
thankfully,
kind of,
no one was hurt.
Well, what kind of response to this did you find in the town?
So there were a few different threads that I could see in my conversations with a lot of people. So one was that people felt like the refugee center, even those who said that they didn't support the AfD, the far-right party, people had a sense that the refugee center was something that they couldn't control, that had been sort of inflicted on them from Berlin, and that maybe there was going to be this kind of uncontrollable tide of refugees coming to their town. And I think there was this sense of kind of impending change that they couldn't control that was leading to a lot of panic. And that's something that I thought was very interesting because it's actually something that social scientists who study populism and especially this far-right populism have seen as a trend across Europe and even in the United States, that when people think, you know, they see kind of diversity rising near them, when they think it's about to come to their town, that's often the time when this kind of politics rises.
What's called the halo effect.
Exactly. So they call it that because you often see it, you know, you see a rise of populism in what looks like a ring or a halo around really diverse areas. So, you know, the suburbs east of London, for instance, have a lot of anti-immigrant politics, voted very heavily for Brexit, in many cases as heavily as some of the depressed northern post-industrial towns that have gotten much more attention.
But according to the Berlin Institute for Population and Development, migrants represent 25% of the population of the former West Germany, but just 4 to 9% of the population in the East. Are the states in the East more hostile to immigrants and refugees, more fearful, despite the fact that fewer are there?
So this is actually a really interesting pattern that shows up over and over, which is that hostility and fear of immigrants is actually higher in places that have low populations, but that are proportionally rising very quickly. So you are more likely to see, for instance, anti-immigrant politics rising in a place that's going from being 3 or 4% immigrant to 5 or 6% immigrant than you are in a place that's going from 30% to 35%.
For example, Berlin, which has a large Turkish population by now integrated into the city's culture.
Right. And so, you know, Buch is, I think, a good example of this in that it is several miles from the most diverse areas of Berlin. And one of the political scientists who I interviewed about this, Eric Kaufman, said that one way to think about it is almost like a nuclear power plant. So if you live close enough to a nuclear power plant but to see it, but you don't understand it, it's something that's kind of always there. It feels threatening and confusing. Whereas if you're close enough to live right there, you probably understand it very well. Perhaps your family works there. It's no longer a concern for you because you know that the safety precautions that are in place. And then he said, you know, people who are way out in the countryside and can't see it at all probably don't think about it. And we see the same things with patterns of diversity. So people who are in very diverse areas, it's part of their normal life. They don't think about it. They understand it well, and it tends to be less of a concern for them because they have contact with people of all backgrounds every day. But it's people who don't have that kind of contact but are close enough that diversity seems like something that it might come to their area soon. There you start to see a lot of anti-immigrant politics, a lot of rising populism.
You mentioned London. East London was a center of far-right activity in the 1970s, but as it became more diverse and the whole area became more diverse, far-right support fell, but then it rose in whiter suburbs just beyond them.
Exactly. So the halo is sort of expanding outward as more and more places become diverse.
We're going to take a little break, and we'll come back with more of this and its implications for the United States and other parts of the world as we talk with Amanda Taub of the New York Times. Her recent article is How a Sleepy German Suburb Explains Europe's Rising Far-Right Movements. Stay with us for more. And we are back with Amanda Taub of the Times. Her article, How a Sleepy German Suburb Explains Europe's Rising Far-Right Movement, has inspired this conversation. Emo Fritsch, a political scientist at the University of Leipzig, says that when people feel they've lost control, they seek a strong identity that will make them feel part of a powerful group.
Right.
And you mentioned earlier the alternative for Germany. Why a right-wing group rather than a left-wing group?
So I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One thing to say is that it's not necessarily just right-wing groups. So one thing that Professor Fritsch has found is that that kind of desire often leads to polarization. So some people will become more left-wing as well as some people become more right-wing. But in Germany, I think that there is a particular twist on this, which is that the alternative for Germany is offering this kind of very powerful German identity. So it's not just that they are saying, you know, support our party because we're powerful. They're also saying that they will make Germany more powerful. And so they're
making
kind of
Germany
promising
great again?
Something like that. They don't use exactly those words, but it's definitely a sentiment that I think would sound familiar to people here who remember our recent presidential campaign.
Actually, they said they're promising to fulfill a desire for patriotism that would be routine, you're saying, in most other countries.
Mm-hmm.
When was the party founded?
It's only a few years old, so the alternative for Germany has only been around for a few years. And even though, you know, they have never gotten a particularly significant share of the vote, their rise has been pretty meteoric. So, you know, they did very well in local elections recently. They were, at the end of last year, polling at about 13 or 14% in many polls nationally in Germany. That's now down a few points. It's not clear why, but it seems like voters are not quite as excited about them.
Well, they won 22% of the vote in Buch in the 2016 elections.
Right.
Well, 22% of the vote in an American election wouldn't be seen as particularly strong showing. What percentage of the vote was for other far-right parties, moderate parties, and parties on the left?
So I honestly don't remember off the top of my head what the exact breakdown was, but I think the key thing to remember is that because Germany is not just a two-party system like we have, 22% was actually more than any other party in that local area. So, you know, that was what it took to win. And that pattern played out in other local elections in other parts of Germany as well.
In halo communities mostly?
In Halo communities, also in some of the kind of places that we would think about as being more typical, so, you know, poor cities that maybe used to have an industrial base. And actually the city of Dresden in the east is generally seen as the kind of center of far-right activity in Germany, and that the AfD did well in their local elections in that part of Saxony as well.
You spoke with Björn Höcke, the head of the Alternative for German Party. What did he tell you is the reason for creating the party and its success?
So Höcke is he's a pretty polarizing figure within the AfD. He's definitely the kind of far right of the party, and he is an important figure, but I wouldn't want to say that he kind of represents all of it. But he really says that identity is the key issue in Germany today, that it is the kind of path to everything. And he made a very controversial speech, actually, where he called for Germany to essentially start conceiving of its past with Nazism and the Holocaust in a new way. So he criticized, for instance, the fact that Germany has the memorial to the Jews killed in the Holocaust right in the middle of Berlin. He said that no other country would put a monument to its shame in the middle of the capital like that.
But those Jews were Germans. Why doesn't he see it as a monument to Germans who died?
I think in his opinion, this is really a barrier to Germans embracing the kind of hardcore version of national identity that he believes that they're entitled to. But I think that he's also doing something fairly savvy politically, which is that he has recognized that there is this kind of yearning for identity and a sense that among many people, particularly young people, that they've been denied it almost through a kind of political correctness. They feel oppressed. They feel like the rules against having that identity are unfair. And he has very much taken up that argument. And this is a way for him to say that it basically he's offering something that everyone is entitled to and mainstream politicians are too afraid and too kind of concerned about controlling discourse from the top down to offer it.
You describe his party's placards as showing grinning, swarthy men clutching handfuls of euros.
Yes.
So is his party kind of racist?
I would say they certainly would say no, but it is very clear that they play heavily on the politics of racial resentment in Germany. So they will heavily imply that foreigners are, you know, non-German, can never truly be German, are just coming to take advantage of the kind of innocent, pure German people and their welfare state. And so, you know, you can never say that every single member of a party believes a particular thing, but it's very clear that they are absolutely willing to play on those resentments and stoke them for political gain.
I wonder how the immigrants who live in Buch responded to all of that.
I think they're concerned. I spoke to some people in the refugee center, and they said that, you know, on the one hand, they can understand why the people in Germany might be concerned about the large numbers of refugees, and they're very grateful for all the assistance that they've received. But I think there's also a sense that this hostility could be dangerous for them. You know, the fire that was set in the refugee center in Buch was not an isolated incident. There have been fires in refugee centers all over East Germany. And I think, you know, we don't know the specific circumstances of that individual attack, but taken together, it seems like these are definitely designed to send a message and to stoke terror.
Well, often opposition to more immigration has an economic side, but Germany has one of the strongest economies in the world. The Berlin Institute for Population and Development notes that there's a wide disparity in wealth between the former East and West states. Maybe is that a factor here?
It could be, but what we see when we look at the data about where populist parties do well, it's really not as simple as whether they're doing well or badly economically. You know, they don't track income particularly closely. The people who vote for these parties tend not to be the poorest in their countries. But what I think is a more convincing argument is that when you kind of take a step back and look at the broader economic circumstances, things like whether people expect their children to do as well or better than their parents, whether towns' local economies are growing or shrinking or, you know, stagnating, that kind of thing turns out to have a little bit more of an effect on whether people vote for these parties. And so I think what it really shows is how much of this politics is local and how much of it is about whether people feel hopeful or dispirited about their future.
WNYC and The Nation have a podcast, United States of Anxiety, that has explored the issue of economic security. It did it last fall when its reporters interviewed Trump supporters who live in Suffolk County. And in that case, they were people who had jobs, owned businesses, had benefited from the social contract of the 20th century. And yet they describe a fear of what comes next. Does that sound similar to the sorts of things you heard in Buch and Potsdam?
I think it absolutely does. And, you know, there's a sense that for a lot of people, they're looking back at what they see as a golden age. And, you know, several people kind of jokingly told me that everybody's golden age is a little different and it wasn't a time that actually existed. It's just a time that isn't happening now. But there's definitely a sense, I think, in Western Europe that there was a time when the welfare state was more secure and stable, and they're worried about the future. They're worried about what's coming. And I think that that, again, is something that these far-right parties have been able to exploit very deftly, because they turn it once again into a story of us versus them. So they say these immigrants, these outsiders, they're coming to take advantage of our welfare state. And that's a way to kind of feed into the anxiety that people have about the future. And, you know, they don't mention the fact that a growing workforce is actually buoyed by immigration, and that often is what supports the welfare state.
Your colleague Alyssa, I'm sorry I interrupted you, but okay. Your colleague Alyssa Rubin wrote that Donald Trump may be a reason the Dutch recently defeated their far-right politician Geert Wilders. And this past Sunday, the Alternative for Germany won just 6% of the vote in a regional election in the state of Saarland. Is that just a fluke, or do you think that support for the party is waning and that Angela Merkel's prospects for re-election may have improved a bit?
So I think we're seeing a few different things kind of blending together right now. One is that some support for the AfD in Germany did fall. It seems like the speech that Mr. Hucke gave about the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin was unpopular with some people. So I think that had an effect.
5 seconds.
But I think also what we're seeing is that some of the mainstream parties are co-opting the populist argument.
Amanda Taub.
In the Netherlands.
Amanda, we got to go, unfortunately. Thank you so much for being with us. Her article, How a Sleepy German Suburb Explains Europe's Rising Far-Right Movements.